Right, thank you, James, for reading that. I was a little concerned that when I was invited to speak on this passage that actually I'd never get to actually speak on the passage because it would take so long to read it. And when I was chatting to Maria about just how much is in this passage, she said to me, do you know what, you could preach for 2 hours on this. So all I'm going to say to you is be glad that Maria is not up here. But actually, I reckon you could preach 4 completely different sermons on the passage we've just read. And actually, if you've been around in church for as long as I have, you've probably heard each of these 4 sermons and heard them several times over. So, living water, true worship, looking at the woman herself, she's normally seen as a sinful woman, an immoral woman, and we'll talk about that later. And then there's this interesting conversation between the disciples and Jesus about reaping and sowing. And then there's the punchline at the end, which talks about lots of Samaritans coming to Jesus. And so there's another narrative at the end there about how the gospel spreads, and we'll spend some time on that as well. But there is a danger in recognising that there are 4 sermons to preach, because the risk is I'll try and preach all 4 sermons. So I'm not going to do that. Now, just a reminder of what John is trying to do in his gospel. And he actually says towards the end of the gospel, actually, all the books in the world would not be enough to contain everything I want to tell you. So basically, John's gospel, he says, is like Match of the Day. It is edited highlights. And those highlights have been chosen so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's why he has chosen what he has chosen. We also know that he wrote 40 to 50 years after the events that he's telling us about here. And so he's had a lifetime of ministry. He was one of the apostles. He has a lifetime of ministry to reflect on what was it, you know, in that whirl of 3 years that I was with him, what was it? What was it that really tells us who he was? And how can I put that in my gospel so that people can recognize him and come to him? And so, one of the things I want us to think about today, but perhaps is worth thinking about over this series, is why did John put this particular story in? Because there were so many others. Another bit of context. Jesus has been in Judea. He's walking up to Galilee, due north. That's like walking from here to Northampton. It's about that sort of distance. And Samaria is in the way. It's a bit in the middle. Now, we know from other incidents that quite often Jesus took a detour. We're in the middle of the west bank of the Jordan River here. And we know that Jesus took a detour up the east bank sometimes. So, on this occasion, he decided to go through Samaria. It says he had to go through Samaria. And that is a missional imperative. He had to go through Samaria because of this missional opportunity that he saw, which we will come on to. And we get this comment that Jews don't associate with Samaritans. Now, a way of thinking about that is Jacob's Well is very close to the Palestinian city of Nablus, And Nablus, and this is in what used to be the occupied West Bank. So Nablus is surrounded by Israeli settlements. And a way of thinking about that historic antagonism between Jews and Samaritans, think of Israelis and Palestinians, and you'll get the idea. And then another bit of context. We're familiar with the idea that women, you could almost view them as second-class citizens somehow. They had an inferior status in these patriarchal societies. But it went further than that. If you were a rabbi, a teacher, you simply did not associate with women, even members of your own family, in public. And there's this wonderful story that's in William, a lot of us will be familiar with William Barclay's commentaries from the 1970s. It said there were even Pharisees who were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees because they shut their eyes when they saw a woman on the street and so walked into walls and houses. So I love that. I just share that as a bit of a joke there. But the point was, Jesus went through Samaria. That was unheard of. He associated with a Samaritan. That was unheard of. He associated with a woman in public. That was unheard of. He was breaking down every barrier. So, we are not actually going to look in detail at living water. Spoiler alert, the idea that just as we need physical bread and physical water, we need spiritual bread and spiritual water will come up again. Fear not. Chapter 6, chapter 7, it will come up again. And true worship, we already had this, James was speaking to us about it 2 or 3 weeks ago. And that will come up again. But the idea that worship is no longer in a place or in a particular form, that we can meet with God wherever and just as well, because we are not Jews. In the context of this story, we're the Samaritans. We're the outsiders. But worship has moved out of the temple and it's moved wherever God is to be found and in whatever form, whether it's the young people's forms of worship or it's the forms of worship we enjoy in this particular service. So, editorial decision, match of the day. We are going to focus on the character of this woman. This is a woman who encounters Jesus, who meets Jesus, who recognizes who Jesus is. So who is this woman? Now, on the basis of this exchange here, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus says to her, you've had 5 husbands and you're living with a man who's not your husband. Now, in our tradition, in our evangelical tradition, this woman is cast as an immoral woman because of this. And that may be true, but there are other explanations of why a woman might have had 5 husbands. Do you remember in Matthew chapter 22, the Sadducees come to Jesus and say, a woman has been married 7 times because each of her husbands has died. Do you remember Ruth and Boaz and the idea of the kinsman redeemer and so on? It's something called levirate marriage. The idea that to be on your own as a woman in these societies, in your middle age, because she presumably was very, very precarious. Very, very precarious. So there are other explanations. She could just simply have had bad luck. We don't know. It's interesting when you look at, quote, liberal commentaries on this passage, they see the woman as a victim. So they see her condition as tragic. So the point is, we don't know why she'd had five husbands. It may well be that she'd lived an immoral lifestyle. We know that Jesus consorted with tax collectors, prostitutes, sinners of all sorts. That's why he came. But we don't actually know. So Jesus says to her, look, I know everything about you. And he leaves it at that. And then the woman says, I can see you are a prophet. And then they go into this dialogue they go into this dialogue about true worship. So, who is this woman? She's undoubtedly an outsider. She's a Samaritan. She's a woman. She may be a social outcast. People speculate because she came to draw water in the middle of the day, not at the beginning or end of the day, when it would have been cooler, is a sign that she was a social outcast. What we do know is that later in this passage, when she goes back to the village and says, come and see this man, the people come. So she's not that much of an outcast. This is the longest dialogue in the scriptures between Jesus and somebody who isn't one of the disciples. And it's a very confident dialogue. Or it's a very brazen and brash dialogue. And you'll read commentaries that present it either way. Perceptive or evasive? So when Jesus says to her, I know everything about you, her response is, I can see you are a prophet. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, 130, 140 years ago, said, it would be far better if she'd said she could see that she was a sinner. And there's a whole thread of commentary in our evangelical tradition that basically wants to push that line. This woman is a sinner. So, is it an immoral life or an unfortunate life? Her view, she does not say, you found me out. You found me out. You've put your finger on the immorality of my lifestyle. I repent. I turn from that. We would prefer that she said that, wouldn't we? But she doesn't say that. Jesus's view. Again, we would prefer that Jesus explains that she's lived an immoral lifestyle. We would prefer that Jesus says to her at the end, go away and sin no more. And he does say that in chapter 8 when he meets another woman. But he doesn't say it in this one. He just says, look, I know everything about you. And John doesn't give us that information either. So, John's writing this so that we may believe in Jesus as the Messiah and have life in his name. And what I think John is saying to us, yes, this woman was a sinner. And she's not unusual in that. Actually, this is a nameless woman. We could put our names on this. Stephen, James, Grant. I know everything you ever did. I know everything you ever did, and yet I accept you. I love you. There are things I know about you that you've forgotten. There are things that I know about you that you wish other people didn't know. But I accept you. And he would say to all of us, go away and sin no more. But John doesn't feel the need to spell that out here. So who is this woman? Well, one of the themes in John's Gospel is the contrast between the dark and the light. And actually we have the highly respected teacher of the law in chapter 3 who comes in the dark, in secrecy. And here in chapter 4 we have this woman who speaks to Jesus in the day, in the light. She is also an example, as I've said, she's an example of this is a gospel for sinners. And that's what I think John was thinking of 40 to 50 years later. She also speaks to us of witness as a response. Come and see. Come and meet this man. And this was a fruitful response. We don't know that about Nicodemus. Equally, we don't know that it was not about Nicodemus. But we do know that about this woman. Many of the Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. The other thing we would like to know is, how does this end? Does she go away? Does she reform her life? Is her life magically changed? We would love that to be the case, wouldn't we? You know, the classic conversion narrative. But John doesn't tell us that. Why doesn't he tell us? Because he didn't think it fitted his purpose. Interestingly, in other traditions, people have felt the need to fill in the gaps. So in other traditions, the Orthodox tradition and the Catholic tradition, this was a nameless woman. I think there's a strength in it being a nameless woman because we can put our own name. In other traditions, there's lots of medieval art on this. I found a bit of piece of modern art. She is called Photina, Photini, or Photine, which is from the Greek, means the luminous one, the lighted one. And she's a saint. She has her own saint's day. And actually, one early church father said that her witness was said to have brought so many to the faith that she is described as equal to the apostles. And one of the stories said she brought 100 members of the Emperor Nero's household to faith. Now, there are lots of traditions, obviously. Lots of traditions, lots of stories about saints. Some of them might actually have a grain of truth in them. But my point is, other people have invented a story for this lady. We should not be tempted to invent a story for this lady that goes beyond what the scriptures tell us. And so we get to the final point. Why did John put this in? And the story begins with the story of the woman, it ends with the story of the woman, and in the middle there's a bit about the disciples reaping and sowing. How the gospel spreads, I think, is why John put this in here. Somebody meets Jesus. Somebody engages with Jesus. Somebody says, you are the Christ. You are the Messiah. Somebody says, come and see. And the cycle repeats. So I think that's what John had dwelled on for 40 to 50 years, and why he wanted us to read about this woman and understand about how she beheld Jesus, followed him, and exalted him.